Hi, my name is Mike Gibb, and I run AccountsRecovery.net. I'm excited to bring you today's webinar on how the Trump administration has impacted the ARM industry. We've got a great panel of speakers, and I know that nobody signed up to hear my voice, so let me get through my opening remarks as quickly as we can so we can get to the discussion. It's being generously sponsored by LexisNexis Risk Solutions. You'll get the chance to hear more about them a little later in our program. I wanted to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, including the Daily Digest email newsletter and the Getting to Know profile, as well as hosts webinars like this and delivers information across a multitude of communication channels. For example, the site has launched 3 podcasts in the past 2 months, with more on the horizon. The site is free for everyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. And I'm not just saying that because it's mine. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what the site has to offer. Let me tell you a little bit now about today's speakers. Roseanne
Mike,
Anderson.
Your audio is breaking up.
Is it? I'm sorry. Let me see if I can try and find a different one here. Let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. Roseanne Anderson is the Chief Compliance Officer for Ontario Systems. She is responsible for driving the company's consumer financial law compliance program, designing innovative compliance solutions for Ontario Systems products, and leading the company's compliance consulting services and compliance outsourcing programs. Her two decades of experience in the ARM industry make her one of the most respected experts in the ARM industry. Gordon Beck is the CEO for Diversified Consultants Incorporated, where he has been employed for 19 years. An amazing culture and never straying away from the family mentality has led to DCI's meteoric growth, represented by offices opening all over the country, and DCI breaking the 1,000 FTE mark. To Gordon, there is no personal achievement that means as much to him as knowing that he provides a great place to work for the people he cares most about, his DCI family. Last September, Gordon became the youngest inductee into his Fern Creek High School Alumni's Hall of Fame, specifically as a result of his accomplishments in the ARM industry. Joanne Needleman is leader of the Consumer Financial Services Regulatory Compliance Group at Clark Hill. She is the immediate past president of the board of directors of the National Creditors Bar Association, formerly known as NARCA, and also served on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's Consumer Advisory Board. Rick Purr is a partner with the law firm of Feinman, Krechstein & Harris and a nationally recognized authority on creditors' rights, including the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and the Telephone Consumer Protection Act. Rick, who is also president of ACA International, a trade association representing the debt collection industry, advises entities and individuals on matters related to compliance in the credit and collection industry, including review, implementation, and auditing of policies and procedures, especially in adherence with government regulatory bodies such as the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The format for today's webinar will be a discussion moderated by myself. We encourage everyone to submit questions, and we'll get to them when the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. Finally, before we launch into the discussion, I want to read the following disclaimer. This information is not intended to be legal advice. It may not be used as legal advice. Every effort has been made to ensure this information is up to date. It is not intended to be a full and exhaustive explanation of the law in any area, nor should it be used to replace the advice of your own legal counsel. Any opinions expressed are the opinions of the speaker and not their organization. And with that, let's begin today's discussion. First, I thought we'd spend a few minutes just sort of setting the scene and setting the table before we delve into some of the more specific parts of the administration and how President Trump has had an impact on the ARM industry. So the first question I'd like to ask is the state of the ARM industry better or worse since President Trump took office about 18 months ago? And how much of that can be attributed to the new president? And Roseanne, I'll ask you, I'll give you the chance to answer first, if you don't mind.
All right. Well, thank you, Mike. I definitely think the state of the ARM industry, along with arguably business in general, is better since President Trump took office. The tough thing about the question in terms of how much you can attribute to him personally, I guess, is maybe beyond my pay grade. But what I will say is that he has created an atmosphere and an environment that if anybody was reluctant to support business, was reluctant to look at both sides of consumer issues before. I think now they know that they have absolute carte blanche opportunities to, you know, when they're dealing with industry groups, for example, whether it's the FCC or the CFPB, I think they know from the top down that not only may you listen to the business side of, but you should listen to the business side of the story. I will leave that as my comment to this question. I know we've got a great group of panelists today, so who wants to take the baton? What do you think?
Well, Roseanne, I'll jump in and say that I think that one thing we can say with respect to the current administration is that morale in the industry is better. People have a hope. They have a vision of the future. They see their businesses being successful. The general business climate just in today's age versus maybe ages past, I don't know if it's changed as much in that the demands by the creditors, for example, on making sure that the entities that they're dealing with adhere to all the regulations, that you meet a certain level of sophistication in your businesses, does create a little bit of a barrier to new entrants into the business. We have a whole slew of mergers and acquisitions. So it may not be easier to become a member of the ARM industry today and facing the slew of consumer lawsuits that you're facing and the cost to operate, but I think that the people that are in it feel that their opportunities to overcome those challenges are definitely in a much better place in the last couple of years than they were previously.
This is Gordon. I'd like to chime in, and I think there's a two-part answer to this. First and foremost, anything and everything that we want to accomplish in our lives, business, professional, or personal, has to do with the attitude that we take when we take on the challenges of life. And I could tell you that I keep my finger on the pulse within my company, and by doing so, I listen to phone calls quite often. And I can tell you without a shadow of a doubt that the other end of the phone now is a lot more pleasant to deal with. I've learned that a lot of people don't know much about politics up and beyond what they hear through the media, which is a shame. But what they do know is what they see. And with the new tax plan in play and more money in the pockets, with businesses coming back to the United States, job creation at an all-time high, unemployment at an all-time low, we're looking at a situation where consumers not only are paying the debts, but they're doing so they're not just paying $5 a month anymore. We're getting settlements. We're getting a lot more balance and fulls. So we can see on the other end of the phone that the consumers are much more confident, much more excited, much more interested in their credit. And I think that also is a domino effect. When you have that going on the other end of the phone, then our agents are more excited than ever, making more bonus money than ever. Again, there's a lot of things, and those aren't even regulatory issues. I think from the stance of removing Cordray and getting in Mulvaney and then hopefully a permanent individual in the next 30 days or so will be great because of their mentality. I think that the recent decision regarding rolling back the decision on the ATDS and the capacity issue is huge. But I can also say that if I were going to look at anything that would be not favorable, is something that maybe Donald Trump has no control over or the administration has no control over, and that is the quite awful regulation that's being handed down or trying to be handed down by the states as a form of making money. So if I were to give any suggestion on how we could combat that, we have to get involved with the all of the associations, the ACA especially, and to get out there and to fight against regulation at the state level that's being handed down by people that see dollars and don't understand our business.
Excellent. Joanne, let me ask you, are there any particular areas or any particular sectors where you can point, you can say President Trump maybe has had, you know, sort of the single greatest impact on the ARM industry?
Maybe. To kind of coalesce everybody else's point, I mean, there's certainly a deregulation theme that's going on, that has been going on for the last 18 months. But look at agencies is like the OCC, maybe even the FTC, or more of the prudential regulators, excuse me, the OCC, the Fed, the FDIC. I think the recent decision by the OCC to let banks get involved in payday lending, what does that have to do with the ARM industry? Look, as I've always said, this is a credit ecosystem. So it always starts with lending, and then we get involved at some point in the cycle, in a very important point in the cycle. So as more lending is happening, eventually there's going to be a cycle of debt. So that would be good for the industry, and I think that President Trump is really trying to encourage that. I just want to make one other point to what Gordon said, and I agree, you know, wholeheartedly with all the points that he made. I want to point out that our industry for the last 5 years, it has been difficult, but let's not forget what our industry did over the last 5 years, and that was build very robust compliance management systems and policies and procedures. So that was difficult. I don't think our industry should back away from that. I think that now those investments have been made, and those investments are starting to pay off in the ability, now that the economy is better, to then be able to have the infrastructure in which, you know, consumers now are more willing to engage us and talk to us and pay their legitimate accounts when they're coming due. So those are the 2 points I have.
Interesting. Does anybody else want to share any perspectives on where they think President Trump has had the single greatest impact, you know, beyond what, you know, what you've said already?
Well, this is Rick. I mean, I could point to one single factor, which is the just the viewpoint on regulation specifically. There's a distinction between what we'll define as more liberal conservative viewpoint on the law. A conservative viewpoint carries with it the idea that only regulate where needed, adhere to the strict construction of the law and what's written, and don't go beyond the words that are on the page. And you see that whether it's with what's going on in a judiciary or a regulator point, but from the executive, it's on the role that, look, there's a bunch of agencies and they're not going to issue regulations unless there's something that's needed to be there. And if there's stuff on the books that needs to come off because it goes beyond the purview of the administrative agency or body that's been charged with engaging in a particular task, then there's no fear in taking that off. And you see that in the industry today. You see that with everything as we go through the topics of the day and talk about what's going on at the CFPB or at other agencies and why isn't this happening or why isn't that happening. I mean, it all stems from the same common core, which is the top of the pyramid has said, stop with the overregulation, go through your books, figure out what's on there that shouldn't be on there, and don't move forward with anything unless you take at least 2 regulations off. And that's had a very wide ripple effect throughout all of the entire executive branch.
Great, thanks, Rick. At this point, I want to pause our discussion, and I'd like to invite Linda Straub-Jones from LexisNexis Risk Solutions to say a few words. Linda?
Thanks so much, Mike. Thanks for allowing us to say a few words, and thank you to this wonderful panel of speakers for your time in discussing this collection industry topic today. LexisNexis Risk Solutions supports the credit and collection industry through its comprehensive database of information on individuals and businesses. We compile data from over 10,000 sources to provide access to over 283 million consumers, excuse me, and 51 million businesses. Our patented matching and linking technology, which we call LexID, assigns a unique and persistent identifier to each consumer, and this identifier connects consumer information maintained in our data sources together, providing a comprehensive view of each consumer. You may be most aware of LexisNexis through our Accurant for Collections or Banco products, but we also offer batch scrubs and monitoring, as well as data hygiene and scoring. So whether you're looking for new contact information, assets, identification of cell, landline, et cetera, we can help you with that. Additionally, while the bureaus have removed judgments and liens, we still offer access to that important information. We deliver access to millions of unique phone numbers that are updated daily, vetted with proprietary data cleaners, and we continually perform internal benchmarking tests on those and with a head-to-head independent competitive feedback. And our phone solutions are consistently outrank our competitors' right party contact rates. So if you want to know anything more about our products, please feel free to contact me at linda.straub@lexisnexis.com or by phone at 612-215-7469. Thank you so much, Mike.
Thanks, Linda. And thanks again to LexisNexis Risk Solutions for sponsoring today's webinar. Let's pick up our discussion. What I'd like to do now maybe is spend a few minutes looking at some of the different regulatory agencies that have oversight over some or all of the ARM industry. And let's talk a little bit about each agency and maybe how that's changed over the last 18 months. And let's start first with the CFPB or the BCFP, depending on how which side you're on or whether you've adopted the new name or not. We expect President Trump to nominate a permanent director of the agency within the next 30 days. Knowing what we now know about President Trump, what can the ARM industry expect from the next person to run the Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection? Gordon Malesk, we'll give you the chance to speak up first.
So I've fortunately, and this is, it's only a coincidence, but we are the first agency after Mulvaney to come in for us to start another audit. I know that they had been put on pause for a little while. I believe that there was some commentary about whether or not enforcement action was going on, but I know it's a question for later. But I could tell you that we started our CFPB audit this past Monday, and it is a much different approach. Although we've never been audited before, obviously I know a lot of people that have. Now, the cumbersome accumulation of documentation is still there. It's a lot, and it's a lot of time, but again, that's to be expected. Now what they're doing is they're sending in a team of about 9 or 10 people, and they come to the office, they do the tour, they meet the crew, and by the way, extremely pleasant to deal with, and all they do is kind of get a feel for your, it's generally not even an entire week, and then what they will do is they will go off-site, which they have now, and back to their wherever they live, and they'll go through the paperwork and they'll go through the documentation, and they're going to come back to us and they'll spend a couple weeks pretty much vetting our processes and procedures, and that will be at the end of July. So there's like a 6-week break in between. I can tell you that without a shadow of a doubt, if the old mentality of they're in it to get the money from you, they're in it to come and justify their $600 million budget, I did not get that impression at all. And there was some candid conversations. They're human beings like you and I, and they weren't tight-lipped really about much. And, you know, without getting too specific based on the NDA that I signed, I can unequivocally tell you that their mentality right now is 100%, let's make sure that the people that we're governing are doing things the right way. And I think Mulvaney made that point when he gave the speech to the ACA group last week that, you know, listen, if you're doing the things wrong that you shouldn't be, we're going to get you. And honestly, rightfully, they should. With our intent to change the image of our industry, even us internally in our business, should put our foot down against the bad players and eliminate them in any way possible, because our reputation is going to change things for our industry for many years to come if we do it the right way. The CFPB, as mentioned before, all of our compliance management systems, all the things we've done has been great. I don't think it was fair that a lot of the fines that came out were fines based on rules that had not yet been made. And I think that telling you and giving you an opportunity to fix things is their mentality now, not I got you. Now, in addition to that, last week in D.C., I was able to go to the CFPB offices, and I spent time with the director that was appointed prior to Cordray. It was the interim gentleman and several of their economists. And we literally sat there and we grind through a report that we provided them on dialing so they can help and aid in their rulemaking. And I have to tell you, it was an awesome experience. The big bad CFPB, I just believe under the new administration and the new attitude, I just don't believe that that is currently a warranted stereotype. And I believe that if we're all willing and open and transparent, that everybody will be fine.
Thank you for sharing that the inside information there. Joanne, let me ask you the same question. What do you think the ARM industry can expect from the next person who will be the next permanent director of the CFPB?
Well, I don't think that Trump is thinking about the ARM industry when he's selecting his next director. I think he needs to be thinking about someone that can get confirmed, which I think is going to be difficult depending how the midterm elections pan out. But I think that certainly Director Mulvaney has put forth, I think, a good framework of how a director of this agency under a President Trump should run this particular agency. So my guess is he's going to look for somebody a little bit in the Mulvaney realm. I don't think that debt collection is going to be in the forefront of who the next director is going to be. I think it's definitely going to be someone who's more industry focused, which I don't think is a bad thing. But my sense is it could be someone more middle of the road just so that they can get confirmed. But hopefully they will continue on with some of the initiatives and some of the culture that Mulvaney has developed.
And this is Rick, and let me just add in here. My viewpoint on the confirmation process is that it's going to be difficult. And I'm not so sure that the first person you see nominated is going to be the person that ultimately gets confirmed. You have a environment, particularly in the Senate, where the person's going to have to get 50 votes in favor of confirmation and really, to a degree, be able to overcome a filibuster of 60, which can't happen unless you have some Democrats that go along with the Republicans currently in Congress that are going to say, we want to confirm somebody. And what we do know is that there's at least a block, core block of Democrats led by Elizabeth Warren, who are not going to allow anyone to get confirmed unless it meets with their viewpoint. So what you're really doing is you're going to have to find someone that is going to at least be tolerable to other Democrats, in addition to other Democrats who are willing to buck their party, and particularly the left wing of the party, and deal with whatever blowback will result from someone like an annoyed or pissed off or out for some sort of moderate vengeance in Elizabeth Warren if the nominee is confirmed, which will, you'll see the different wings of the party fight with each other. So you have to find that person. And I think that the first go around is going to be someone that's going to test those boundaries. And because I think the administration is going to put someone that's much more favorable to them and much more going to be anathema to someone like Elizabeth Warren, that you're going to see maybe a fight that doesn't get concluded, or a nominee that withdraws, or a nominee that doesn't get the votes, or can't get a cloture vote to make sure that their nomination comes up on the floor. So you may have to then go back to the drawing board and come up with someone that can then compromise because the boundaries of the fight have been defined at that stage. So it'll be interesting to see, but I think it's in for a long fight. And again, the as Joanne points out, the election change in November could impact it as well. What happens in the Senate in terms of changing some of those numbers? Any nomination that's made this year, of course, is in this particular congressional session. But once January 6th rolls around, we're in another congressional session. And if someone has not been nominated by that point in time, the president would have to nominate the person again, or a new person, because the session starts over again. So I think that we're in for a little bit longer fight than is anticipated. And the person that probably will get nominated will be a lot more moderate than we anticipate, in large part because it will have to be someone that will be tolerable enough to the moderate centrist wing of the Democratic Party, sufficient for them to deal with the wrath of the liberal wing of their party, who's going to say that they betrayed them by approving any nominee of the current president.
One thing I'd like to offer too, this is fascinating information, but the all is well in a sense, because one thing I have learned from just recent conversations with some CFPB representatives is that one thing Mulvaney has done is he's almost created an org structure that will help us, well, let me back up. He's created an org structure quite unlike the org structure under Cordray. And what I mean by that is he has these policy leaders reporting to him. And those policy leaders are learning from him, are bringing him information. It is a reporting structure whereby he is actually deferring more and more to these experienced policy leaders, regardless of the discipline they're in. So the policy leader, obviously, that would matter to us would be, you know, somebody like a Tom Paul, who has now been brought back from the FTC to lead the rulemaking charge. We'll see where that goes. But nonetheless, he's got people that report to him that we didn't really have that kind of a dialogue structure in place with Cordray. So whoever is ultimately appointed, I'm sure, is, well, I would be surprised if they just throw that away and go back to kind of the dictatorship that we had, and would be probably wise to take advantage of the infrastructure now that is in place under Mulvaney.
Can I also add something about the Bureau? I think another thing that's going to come into play to kind of expand on what Rick was saying, yeah, it's going to be a battle. And then the other wrinkle in this fight is going to be whether they push for a commission. Because, you know, right now the rumbling is it's going to be this Nick Waters, who was very favorable to both sides when he was appointed NCUA chair. In fact, Elizabeth Warren supported him. But there's no way that Liz Warren's going to support anybody that Trump picks for the Bureau. It's just, it doesn't matter who they are. So if we're going to get in this constant battle of no nominee is good enough, I think that's going to spur on the debate and the calls for a restructuring of the agency.
That would have to come from within Congress, wouldn't it? I mean, they would have to change amend Dodd-Frank to be able to do that, right?
It's definitely a legislative issue, but you know, look at the bills that are starting to float up that are floating around Congress now. There are several bills right now that call for a structural change of the Bureau, and that could come into play.
And you think that Democrats might be more amenable to that, seeing as how they get at least maybe a couple sort of people that were more aligned with their way of thinking, at least at the top of the agency?
Well, I think what, you know, if the Democrats are going to constantly constantly shoot down any nomination that the president makes, then what's the answer? You know, that they're going to paint themselves into a corner that there is no other alternative but to have a commission, so you don't have to go through this confirmation fight every 5 years.
Well, that's excellent. While we talk about who the next head of the CFPB will be, there are two new chairmen at the Federal Trade Commission and Federal Communications Commission, two other regulatory agencies that have a significant impact on the arm industry. I'd like to get a sense from you, and maybe Rick, you can take this one first this time. What kind of impact changes at the top of those agencies are having on the arm industry?
Well, I think that, you know, you've already seen an immediate impact both in appointments to those agencies and who's being put into staff. What the nature of the viewpoint of, you know, in terms of the FCC, you know, you see Pai and O'Reilly, who have written extensively on a number of issues as previous commissioners, that have set forth a blueprint for what they plan to do. With them in a majority, they'll have a greater ability to accomplish those facts. And you know, with what's happening with the TCPA and the DC Circuit opinion in ACA versus FCC, you have the roadmap blueprint for what Pai and O'Reilly are going to do. They've said it in their dissents to the 2015 declaratory order, in which they said number one thing to deal with, and it runs across the spectrum, not just in enforcement of the TCPA, but how do you deal with robo-dialing and robo-calling and using it in a derogatory term and talking about people who are engaging in this conduct illegally. How do you deal with call blocking, call labeling? And what the overarching theme has been is, number one, enforce the laws that are on the books. Go after the bad actors, the bad people, engage in enforcement and investigation of the people that you need to stop. Number two, don't create legislation or regulation that unnecessarily inhibits legitimate businesses from continuing to conduct their business simply because they may be using technology that has far outpaced legislation and regulation. And so you see how they're going to react. While they haven't done it yet, they at least have indicated in the past what they intended to do had they been in the majority. And I think you can fully expect that's the road that they're going to go down. And I think that also folds back in to this concept of not having overburdening regulation. And that is the hallmark of a conservative government. And so you're going to see that type of government by law and not governing by enforcement that is going to be what we see come out of regulatory and administrative agencies on the executive side for the next several years.
We've seen, we're going to see, the FCC attempt to address the issues that came out of the ruling in the appeals court decision in the ACA lawsuit. Any speculation or any guesses as to what we're likely to see? Now that there's a different chairman at the head of the agency this time compared to what happened in 2015, does anyone want to make any predictions or guesses?
Well, I'll jump in, and this is just a prediction and maybe a wish. But if we go to strict statutory construction and we look at what the TCPA, how Congress defined an automatic telephone dialing system, I'm hoping that Pai, the chairman, will simply interpret the language of the existing law to mean that an auto dialer is what the statute says it is. Basically a device that has the capacity to generate random or sequential numbers and to dial such numbers. And there's no one in the collection industry that I know of that sells or uses software plus hardware that generates random numbers and sequential numbers and dials them. I mean, arguably, the Second Circuit's decision said to the FCC, read the statute, interpret the statute. And I know that would be, that means predictive dialers as we know them today would not fall within the statutory definition of an automatic telephone dialing system. So whether or not that will happen or not, I think I want to, there's no reason for us to not request that type of a result and to appreciate why that type of result is appropriate. And the last comment I'd like to make about this is, maybe this group has already discussed this in other venues, but statutes do obsolesce. In other words, they lose their way. They don't have a purpose anymore. So while arguably the statute might have some value if you want to go after telemarketing, I guess, but if you just simply look at the language of the statute itself, I think it's outdated itself. It's almost, and to be clear, what I mean about an obsolete statute, we no longer, at least where I live, have code sections on the books like where you can tie up your horse. I mean, that you don't need it anymore. It's an obsolete, the law eventually becomes obsolete because there is no need for it. And while arguably people will say robocalling is a problem, blah, 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 I don't think the TCPA is serving any purpose anymore. And certainly not if you really take a look at the statutory definition, and hopefully the chairman and his team will look at it as well and go out on a limb and construct the statute literally.
Hopefully the new leaders will have a plethora of common sense. It's like saying, okay, I'm going to buy a Maserati, and because it can go 150 miles an hour, you might as well give me a ticket right now. It never made sense. It never stopped the true meaning and reason that the TCPA was enacted when it was, and that's for solicitors. We all get called about the warranties expiring on our vehicles. We all get the phone calls about helping save interest rates on our credit cards. And I've even personally heard calls of the IRS scam. Those will never stop. If they're going to govern our industry, maybe they separate it. Maybe they say, this is the amount of times you can call, not telling us that in the 21st century, we can't use technology that we've spent millions of dollars on to do it. Regardless of the capacity, I'm glad that was removed. I just don't feel like there's been enough, not a plethora of common sense out there in some of these decisions, where if the whole issue of having the law is to basically thwart people from robo-dialing massive amounts of time per day, then simply tell us how many times we could dial. The phone's going to ring regardless, the same exact way, no matter how we dial it. Tell us how many times to dial, then you can throw all that out the window about the equipment and all of the millions and millions of dollars that this industry has thrown out the window to predatory lawyers, et cetera, for a law that was never meant for us. So hopefully—
Well, Gordon, too. Yeah, I just want to jump in here. I mean, I think your points are great, but that just supports my position that the TCPA, it actually, in when you read the congressional history, it wasn't to address call frequency. It was to address two things: protecting the privacy of the home during the dinner hour from unexpected interruptions, and with cellular phones, to jump on the bandwagon in 1991 and say these, I'll say it this way, protect these poor consumers who are going to be charged for all these stupid calls that are coming in and they never asked for them. That's what it really was about. We are so far from its intended purpose today, both the way we talk about it, the way we think about it, because we've been beaten by these ridiculous lawsuits. That's why I'm kind of saying, let's look back to what was it first enacted for. Go ahead. I know I jumped in on you, but it just drives me wild with this law.
No, I agree with you totally. I got nothing left to say. You nailed it.
This is Joanne Edelman. Roseanne, always right on. you always succinctly know the right thing to say. And what you're saying is so true. But I want to point out, too, I think what you're seeing, I think the FTC and the FCC are going into an era where they're going to have some significant validity. Not that the FCC didn't, but you know, you're starting to see with the Bureau, and you saw it the last couple of years with the Bureau, and now with the change in the FTC and the FCC, there is so much opportunity now for regulatory influence. I mean, we as an industry have been in the Bureau a lot. Always have welcomed us. We've always had conversations. You know how far they went, and whether we were listened to. That's another story. But this whole idea that we can influence regulators and we have more of a say now with regulators is so important. Because your point, Roseanne, I agree. The TCPA is outdated. Do you think Congress is going to do anything about it? No. I mean that's an area that's just completely paralyzed. They cannot correct everyday problems for consumers, whereas regulators really have a lot of authority now to do that. Now, sometimes that doesn't come out best for our industry. They could be on the wrong side of an issue, but there is so much opportunity at these agencies right now to really kind of set some really good framework of how we want to go about and do our business. And I think the arm industry needs to get into all three of these agencies right now, because the things that they're looking at have tremendous impact on what we do every day.
Interesting. Let's move to a couple of other departments within the executive branch for a quick minute. The Department of Education and the Internal Revenue Service have had, I guess we'll say, mixed results in implementing programs outsourcing unpaid debts to private collection agencies. What do you expect to happen to those programs in the coming months and years? Roseanne, we'll let you take that one first.
Well, I'm not sure what to say. I think, you know, we have such a pull here and conflict, I guess, at the federal level with the privatization of debt collection. One thing I do think is that it's possible that how it's been alarming to read, you know, no more contracts will be let to the third-party debt collectors, et cetera. Maybe we're just going to see a shift to a first party. Maybe these same, you know, the servicers right now, I mean, that sounds like what they're doing with education. Instead of allowing it to go to the third party, they're just saying to the servicers, you do it. And that's a dynamic that we're seeing with credit grantors in every market segment. So I'm not shocked. I'm obviously disappointed because the industry has the expertise in this area to collect the debt. But I do see this first party mode surviving, and I see it touching many, many, many other industries in a very real sense as well, because that's in effect what they're doing. They're saying no more third party. Let's just stick it with the servicers and handle all this debt collection first party.
And I don't, you know, I think that there may be a push to that. You know, Washington's so complicated that, and there's so many different factors, you know, Department of Education may or may not have said something about what they're going to do with defaulted student loan debt. But when you start having members of Congress weigh in, senators, others, which will inevitably happen because all of these companies exist in states with men and women who have great deal of influence in the governmental process and who want to protect the jobs and the economy within their individual states. So when they collectively get together and start pushing on Ed to do certain things, or funding's not going to work out the way they want, or appointments are not going to go in the direction that they desire, what we have today in intent by the department probably won't be the result that we ultimately see. And I think at the end of the day, you're never going to have a scenario in which you put everything in the hands of one party or one person in the private sector. Government's going to diversify as much as it can. And because there's going to be a need to build coalitions among elected officials, and you do that by making sure the business falls in the state. It's a prime example of why the military is so successful. Because when you start building airplanes and ships and weapons, and you put those factories in seven different states, guess what? Now you have seven different allies in the Senate, or 14, and a host of number of members of Congress, all who rely on those programs within their states to keep jobs and economy going. So it's not so easy to kill any of those programs. I think you see the same thing happen in the collection industry, where at least on the conservative end, they recognize that keeping it in the hand of the private sector versus the government is the direction they want to go to. And when they start going in that general area, it'll inevitably lead towards trying to appease as many representatives and senators as they possibly can appease. And that means the most number of businesses in the most number of states.
Let's move on and talk a little bit now about Congress. We've talked about the upcoming midterm elections. do, and we've talked about some of the legislative changes that, you know, maybe the industry would like to see or would definitely benefit from. With the midterms on the horizon in November, does anybody expect to see any legislative changes either before or after, which could impact the arm industry? Or, you know, are we looking at, like what Joanne mentioned, where much of the influence instead will be coming from the regulatory side instead of the legislative side?
Ken, this is Rick. I can't imagine that the members of Congress are going to be able to accomplish much in this industry before November. You're talking about recess happening in the immediacy, although there's some calls for the Senate to come out of recess in August to work on legislation. My understanding from speaking to a couple of House members is they're not coming back. Then you have midterm elections in November. So everyone's appearance in the fall is going to be limited. I guess it depends on what happens in November to determine if certain legislation gets pushed through in lame duck to accomplish things, particularly if you see one or both houses of Congress move. You may see efforts then by the current incumbents to try and get things done before they all depart, before January 6th. But I think we're in a relatively dead legislative area in leading into November. And then depending upon what happens, and you have 2020 around the corner in the presidential election, that it's anybody's guess whether anything at all happens between January 6, 2019 and November of 2020.
That's a fairly bleak outlook, Rick.
It's politics.
I agree with him, though. I absolutely agree with him. I'll tell you, I'll be honest with you. As far as I'm concerned, with regard to any sort of legislative agenda for the arm industry, Trump won, my personal opinion is we have about 4 months before, because, you know, Congress, they just start raising, they fundraise the second they're elected. And so I thought that we had maybe, you know, not the full 2 years prior to the midterms, maybe just about 4 to 6 months to try to impact some legislation. And that didn't happen for a number of reasons, but I don't expect any significant changes in the foreseeable future, with or without a change in the House or the Senate.
And I mean, and if you really go back to a real basic civics lesson, that's how Congress was designed. It was designed not to get things done, but to make sure nothing got done. You know, you have a bicameral legislature where the people are chosen in different formats, and, you know, the Senate being from the whole state, the members of the House of Representatives, they have 6-year terms, 2-year terms. You need to get both parties to agree and to have an executive that's willing to sign things. Congress is designed not to get things done. It was always the founders' input that things be done at the state level, not the federal level. I know that today's economy is obviously vastly different than 1789, but the fact that Congress gets things done probably is more of a miracle than anything else. So our priorities, as much as they are significant and important to us, and it goes back to what Joanne said about the CFPB being a director, we are a small part of this puzzle that's Washington. At the CFPB, we make up very little. In the federal government alone, it's infinitesimal as to what the significance of our legislation is compared to the real other issues that the country grapples with, whether it's, you know, immigration, the farm bill, a whole host of things. I don't think that we're going to be on the top of anybody's list. Maybe something you could slide in on an appropriations bill, or maybe able to get in with some omnibus piece of legislation. But the relief that our industry is going to be getting is going to be primarily from regulators who are going to not have these restrictions to act, whether it's the FCC, and what they're going to do with the TCPA, or what the CFPB may be doing with rulemaking and providing relief in clarity, getting rid of the ambiguity in the FDCPA, embracing technology as a way to service. And I think those are the real things that our members can and our constituencies can look towards, expect and demand of us who are all out there pounding the pavement to say, get these things done. And I think realistically, we can expect to get a lot of that stuff done. And that's where the relationships need to be built, honed, and strengthened. And I have a real positive outlook, even going into 2018, 2019, 2020, that in those areas, the Army industry will be able to see a lot of change that it's been looking for a number of years.
I guess, and anybody can, you know, absolutely correct me if I'm wrong, and there's probably a decent chance that I am, but one of the I guess the most arm-related bill that I've seen in Congress this session is the Practice of Law Technical Clarification Act, which would exempt certain lawyers or lawyers from certain sections of the FDCPA. I know it passed, you know, in committee and is before the polls. Does that mean that nobody expects that to really have any more forward momentum between now and November, or to be reintroduced, you know, in the new session next year?
Well, I can speak to that law. That is moving along quite well. I can't say a lot about it. It did get out of committee. It got out of committee actually very quickly, and there is a sense of, you know, it's a very narrow issue that returns the FDCP original intent, and that was to accept litigation activity. In fact, what is being proposed is very different than what the original FDCPA said. It exempted all attorneys no matter what they did. And I think attorneys understand that there's a lot of things that they do that are subject to the FDCPA. They make phone calls and communicate with consumers just like lay people do every day. But the statutory, this country was built on the fact that lawyers are licensed at the state level, and judiciaries or other entities at the state level regulate attorney conduct. And it's and the other issue is that, you know, it's not about large law firms. It's really about small attorneys who represent small businesses. And small businesses rely on local, small, regional attorneys to help them collect their accounts receivables. I mean, you know, the plumber and the dentist and the landscaper, they don't have legal departments. And that theme has resonated a lot in Congress in this session. So I would not count that bill out.
And to me, it all depends on the Senate. Again, going back to this, are you going to get enough Democrats to sign on to it to get it to pass the Senate? It'll pass the House. And it all depends on how you spin it. If it gets spun as an exemption to attorneys, which it's not, you're going to see a backlash. If the advocates for it can describe it is, which is really to take litigation-related activities where there is already oversight and enforcement by a court, because it's already in court, and to remove that double layer of unnecessary and overburdensome regulation, then I think that you can convince enough moderate and conservative Democrats that we don't need to have an executive agency overseeing the judicial control of litigation in its courtrooms. Explain that way, I think you can convince some people, and we'll see what happens. And maybe it's something, again, that gets done in lame duck on the Senate side.
You mentioned judicial, and we've only got a few minutes left, and we haven't tackled that branch of the government yet. So let's spend the last few minutes on that. Congress has confirmed 39 federal judges that have been nominated by President Trump. Can we assess any impact that these nominations and confirmations have had on the judicial branch, especially related to lawsuits involving, you know, the FDCPA, the TCPA, or the FCRA? Joanne, would you mind weighing in on that one first?
Sure. I'll take the Supreme Court first. I think that Trump's nomination of Gorsuch was a good one. I mean, he's really turned out to be a, he's definitely a strict constructionist. He's not so much in the vein of Scalia, but he has issued some very interesting opinions. As we know, the first opinion that he issued was the Santander case. And I think it was very well written. He issued an opinion about a month or so ago, which was very interesting, that had to do in which Kagan, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, Beyer, and I think Kennedy all sided with him. And it had to do with how a regulatory agency was really about Chevron deference and how a regulatory agency interprets the law. So I thought that was an interesting case. Which, you know, the real liberal side of the bench sided with him. So he's a great pick, in my opinion. I think he reads the law really well. He writes excellent opinions. So I think that's been important. And there certainly are going to be more consumer protection type cases that are starting, that will go up to the Supreme Court, including, in my opinion, Trump, English versus Trump probably will weave its way up there as well. So I think he's a great addition. As far as on the district and circuit court level, I can't tell right now. I think maybe Rick is a better person to talk about that. I haven't seen a whole huge change in some of the decisions I've seen, although there's been some good cases at the Second Circuit, but I don't know whether that's the result of new Trump appointees.
I'll just say there's 92 district courts across the country. Each one probably has judges ranging in the area of 7 to 10 to 20 or 30. That's a lot of judges. And while you may have put 39 more judges in there, you won't see the impact of that for years to come. Now, what can you say generally about people who have been trying to demarcate between a more liberal, moderate, centrist viewpoint is the a conservative judge is going to read the law and what it says. Henson versus Santander is the prime example. The law said, basically, if you own the debt, you're the creditor. And that's how the court read it. And it said, look at the plain language. Look exactly what it says. We're not adding anything in there. So the more judges that come in, I think you're going to be able to find, not that there's going to be more favorable or less favorable to the arm industry, but what you're going to find is that what the law says is what it means. You know, a crazy example is what we deal with in the Third Circuit, in which the Third Circuit Court of Appeals read into this opinion back in the 1990s called Graziano versus Harrison, that somehow a quote in writing requirement applied to the G notice in the first sentence, even though it wasn't in there. Every other court that looked at it all said, guess what? Congress knows what it's doing. It didn't include in writing in the first sentence. It included it in the second and third sentence. You can't read in writing in the first sentence. And that's a very strict constructionalist viewpoint. And that's what these judges are going to do. So can you get something where maybe enough appointees go to the Third Circuit or in the district court so you can get that type of legislation overturned, which has been a real pain in the butt for a lot of people who are trying to engage in the dispute process in the Third Circuit, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, Virgin Islands. That's the type of legislation that you think, or opinion that you think can get changed with the right appointment of judges that suddenly go back to reading the statute. You saw that with the D.C. Circuit, even though there was a majority of appointees were Democratic appointees, but they went back to the real, this is what Congress wrote. The FCC can only regulate and enact what Congress delegated to it, not beyond the scope of the delegation. That's the difference between more conservative judges and more liberal judges. And so you're going to see that trend going forward in the long term. You won't see that much impact in the short term unless you get one of those judges.
Well, we've reached the top of the hour, and I don't want to take up any more time than I promised of our panelists, but I would like to give each of them a chance to provide some parting words on the topic and any other insights that they haven't had a chance to share. So we'll go around the panel and get some last words. And Gordon, we'll start with you. Gordon,
Mike,
you there?
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead. Can you hear me okay? Hear me now. Yeah.
You know, my final words for the group is, first of all, thank you for having me on, and also to everyone that joined for joining. I'm going to make a 50,000 foot synopsis of all of this, because I think that what's important is our industry. I think that unanimously across the panel, we are doing great things and we are going to achieve a great deal in the upcoming years. And our focus needs to be on not just looking at, you know, what is our environment in terms of our administration, but looking within ourselves and saying, what can we do to keep it this way for good? And if people get involved, participate with your local state units, participate with the association, any and all that you can, and literally, you know, give your time to this industry. None of us are as strong as all of us. Together, there's nothing we can't accomplish. But it's time that we decide that we're going to stop, you know, being the whipping boy, and we're going to stop being stereotyped, and we're going to prove to the world what we do that's great, how much we bring back to every American's table every single month, and the stereotype of doing it the wrong way, that is what we call caveman collections. It's not even relevant anymore. But in order to get that message across, in order to ride this wave into the future, we have to participate, we have to do it together, and we have to volunteer our time. So that's all I have to say.
Well put, thank you. Roseanne.
Let me close with it. Thank you, of course, Mike, for inviting me. I love being on these panels. Very, very informative. My closing comment would be very specific. The CFPB is, or the BCFP, is still in existence. Notwithstanding all of the good news that we shared and our observations, it still exists. The CFPB has a burr under its bonnet about FCRA investigations. So if you are listening and you are a data furnisher, do not become lax. In fact, be aggressively concerned about your policies and procedures regarding dispute investigations under the FCRA, particularly the eOSCar disputes. I predict that we're going to see some enforcement actions surrounding that issue, and I don't want us to be basically, let's not fall asleep at the switch. We have done some great work, as Joanne said, with our compliance management systems. Now is not the time to relax. Let's just maintain the status quo and do our good work. That's it.
Thank you very much. Rick?
Well, the lessons to be learned in everything, one is elections have consequences. We understand that when we go to the polls, when we vote for the people that we're voting for, when we contribute. And they'll have distinct results because of the actions of a group of people. And so, and that action doesn't take place overnight. So it is incumbent upon everyone who's listening and to everyone who's in the industry to understand that working today, donating money, participating in campaigns, lobbying, going to meet your members of Congress, talking to people about even locally who may one day be your member of Congress, is an important aspect to plant the seeds that's going to grow over a long period of time. At ACA, we had the benefit of hearing from a couple years ago, Carl Rove, who came to talk to us and talked about how you have to have a 5, 6, 7 year plan as a trade association to try and get things done in Washington, because that's the way it works. We're seeing a lot of the benefits of that plan today, and that stuff can change overnight, but it doesn't mean that we have to stop doing the hard work, the groundwork, to continue the dialogue, to make sure that everyone's in the best position possible, regardless of the political climate out there. So I think that what we take from this is it's a good time. The window's open. It's going to close inevitably, as with any cycle, but keep chugging along, doing what you're doing, because regardless of whether the party in power is Democratic or Republican, we're still businesses that have a great impact within their communities in terms of votes, dollars contributed, participation, charity, and tax work that will lead anyone in any party to come to the same conclusion, which is that our industry brings a lot back to the U.S. economy and is an integral part and needs to be listened to on a lot of different issues.
Well said, thank you. And the honor of the last words go to Joanne Needleman. Joanne?
Thanks, Mike. And thank you all to my panelists. It was just a great conversation. I don't have more to add. I'll just kind of reiterate what I said during the presentation is that I think that as far as regulation, huge opportunities for industry to be influential in their decision-making now as they seem to have more and more power and seem to be more and more relevant. We also have opportunity now, you know, with the change of administration to really garner some certainty in what we do so that when the next administration comes along, there's no question about what our obligations and responsibilities are. I think that was a real difficult part of what we all had to live through over the last couple of years. And, you know, I'm not in favor of these vast swings. I mean, I'm very favorable towards Mick Mulvaney and what he's doing, but, you know, he's 180 degrees different than Cordray, and you can't keep having these vast swings of directors come in. It's not good for business, certainly not good for the financial services industry as a whole. So I think that we would benefit a lot, especially the arm industry, because we have so many smart, compliant innovators to ensure that we keep some consistency going along through the next change in politics, through the next change in administration. So I appreciate, Mike, you putting this panel together. I thought it was really helpful.
Well, thank you. Wise words to end our discussion on. Before I let everyone go, I wanted to thank Roseanne, Gordon, Joanne, and Rick for their insights and their time today. This webinar definitely would have been far less interesting if it had just been me trying to answer these questions. So thank you for their participation and their insights. I also want to thank LexisNexis Risk Solutions for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to risk.lexisnexis.com to learn more about the company or get more information. Thanks to everybody who signed up and participated and listened today. Please stay tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. A recording of this event will be posted on the site probably in the next day or so. And lastly, I hope everyone enjoys the rest of your day. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.